On December 14th, 2025, the world watched in horror as the worst terrorist attack in Australian history was carried out on its most famous beach. A local man, later identified as Ahmed Al-Ahmed, confronted the attackers and managed to disarm one of them. Mr. Al-Ahmed was shot repeatedly during the attack and continues to recover from his wounds. His commendable bravery was lauded by the highest levels of government, with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese calling him the best of our country. However, a few months later, he started to fall out of the public's good graces. Why?
The gentleman who raced in to the scene to disarm one of the gunmen, we're just learning some details about him because he has been shot. Now, we are confident in saying that that is him. We understand that this gentleman's name is Ahmed Al-Ahmed. He's a 43-year-old married father of two. And he raced in to help. We understand... apparently owns a fruit shop in Sutherland. No experience with guns. He was just walking past. We are told that he has two bullets in his arm, but they think he's going to be okay.
It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And 15 people were killed in the Bondi attack, which targeted a Hanukkah celebration attended by no less than 1,000 people. And it would surely have been many more had it not been for the actions of Ahmed Al-Ahmed. In the aftermath of the anti-Semitic attacks, he became the hero of Bondi overnight. Beloved by all sides of Australian communities, he became the face of a diverse, upstanding and honourable Australia. But when he became embroiled in legal issues linked to family, the veneer of public praise could not hold. Media coverage focused heavily on a domestic violence charge and commentary questioned whether the hero's reputation could actually survive. So who is Ahmed Al-Ahmed? Hero? Villain? Or just the right person in the right place at the right time? Well, journalist Jonathan De Burka-Butler joins me today to discuss the scrutiny of a man who has gone from hero to controversial public figure in quite a short period of time. Jonathan, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Ciara, how are you getting on? Thanks for having me on.
So let's go back, right, to that attack. And because of social media and because of so many eyewitness accounts and eyewitness filming, many of us got to see it play out. It was truly, truly shocking.
It was very dramatic, the whole thing. I mean, it was the 14th of December, 2025. And you've always got to remember that, and this sounds obvious, I know, but while it was winter here, it's the height of the summer there. So people are enjoying Bondi Beach. And this Hanukkah celebration is taking place. And as you mentioned in your intro there, there was about 1,000 people at this community event. I mean, it was a family day out. Sun was shining. Everybody's having a nice time and nobody's expecting what's about to happen. I mean, does anybody ever expect these kind of things to happen? And it all happened really quickly. These two individuals, Sajid Akram, who was 50 years of age, and his son Naveed Akram, who's 24, they appear on a bridge near this Arthur Park, which is it was kind of a little appendage to Bondi Beach, right? It's quite a small place where this gathering was taking place. And they go to a bridge there, which isn't particularly far from it, and that's where they start shooting. And as you said, you know, there's footage which shows all of this unfolding, lots of footage from various angles. At one point, Sajid Akram, who is the father, who I think I'll refer to as the father from now on, decides that he wants to get closer, okay, to get closer to his targets. And he descends the stairs and he's shooting into the crowd behind a tree. And it's at this point that Al-Ahmed creeps up behind him and attacks him. He kind of comes up behind him, grabs him around the neck with his right arm and manages to disarm him. Now, at that point, he actually takes the gun off him and he could have there and then turned around and shot him, but he doesn't, right? The father backs away, eventually makes it back up onto the bridge, and unfortunately there's more weapons there and he continues to shoot at people until he himself is shot by police. He also manages to shoot at Al-Ahmed and injures him. Okay, so Al-Ahmed takes two shots in his left arm and he's still recovering from that.
And the footage was extraordinary because there were people clearly in fear of their lives running for safety, right? And you can nearly feel their fear and you can hear their screams. And Al-Ahmed moves towards the gunman.
Yeah.
You know, he does the exact opposite rather than running away from him. And you can see him grappling with the attacker, and you can see him with the gun there, and you can see him getting it and throwing it off, you know, sort of out of harm's way for a moment before he himself is shot. I mean, you can see that so clearly. And he was just an ordinary guy in the area.
Yeah, he was meeting a friend for a coffee. That was it. And he heard the gunshots. His mother later on went on to describe what had happened, that he heard the gunshots. He went towards them rather than moving away from them. And before this event, he was an ordinary guy. Now, it should be said, and it's worth referencing these other people, there were other heroes on the day as well. Indeed, before the father, Sajid Akram, got to the bridge, he was attacked by a couple who I think were in their 50s or 60s, Boris and Sophia Gurman, who were a Russian-Jewish-Australian couple. They disarmed him, but unfortunately the son managed to shoot at them and kill them. There was another individual by the name of Reuben Morrison who confronted one of the attackers, and then there was another guy, Geffen Britton, who was an Israeli citizen living in Australia. Three of these people died, and Geffen Britton hasn't really got the, you know, the praise, I suppose, that he's deserved. So Al-Ahmed has very much been the focus of the hero worship and the focus of the attention, and rightfully so. I mean, a lot more people would have died. There was 15 victims in total. A lot more would have died had it not been for his intervention.
And he's a Muslim Australian himself, Syrian origin.
Yeah, he was from Syria. He moved there in the early 2000s. Now, he's a fruit seller, so moved there in the early 2000s. There's two young girls, I think. And he was living with his family in an area of Sydney called Bankstown, right? So it's a good bit away from where, you know, where this incident took place. Very mixed area. And he decided to get in the middle of this, and it's completely changed his life.
And to say it completely changed his life is a bit of an understatement, right? In many ways, because he was left with these devastating injuries, which he's still suffering from. But there was a GoFundMe page established as people, I suppose, wanted to show their gratefulness for what he had done. And a fortune was raised.
A fortune, an absolute fortune was raised. $2.5 or $2.6 million, Australian dollars. 43,000 people from around the world, I think, contributed to it. And I mean, the praise that he was heaped on him, I mean, he was in hospital for 2 weeks. So you can imagine the media circus that was around him. The Premier of New South Wales came to visit him. The Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, came to visit him.
Well, it was a great honour to meet Ahmed El-Ahmed. He is a true Australian hero. He's very humble, and his bravery is an inspiration for all Australians. His mother and father are here visiting him from Syria, and I was able to meet them as well. They're very proud parents at a moment where we have seen evil perpetrated. He shines out as an example of the strength of humanity. Ahmed El-Ahmed represents the best of our country.
And there was a very interesting incident when he got out of hospital, where he went to the Sydney cricket ground. And I describe it in an op-ed in the Irish Examiner that I wrote around this as being white Australia standing up and giving this immigrant, this Syrian who's come to Australia to make a life for himself, a standing ovation and sort of accepting them finally into their circle. And it was quite a day. And, you know, that $2.6 million was raised in an effort to help him get on with his life, because it's quite possible he mightn't be able to work. He's still very badly injured, still carrying his left arm in a sling, but a very humble individual all throughout the whole thing, and was always concerned in his interviews for other people and what was going on with the victims and their families.
$2.6 million Aussie dollars is 1.4 million euro, 1.43 million okay. euro. I googled it this morning. So okay. It's a life-changing sum
Huge
of money.
Amount.
What happened to him afterwards? I mean, I know he went on this tour of America, didn't he? And he did all of these media interviews. So he was a hero, not just in Australia, but around the world he was being celebrated.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why so many people from around the world pitched in to help him out. But things kind of went sour for him. I mean, it should have been a situation where the rest of his life was more or less sorted out and, you know, people were going to buy him beers for the rest of his life and pat him on the back. But things began to turn a little bit, particularly earlier this month when he appeared in court. Charges were pressed against him. And the charges were very interesting because one of the headlines that a lot of media dealt with was this idea of domestic violence, right? Now, when you think of domestic violence and when I think of domestic violence, we think of one thing, okay?
Which is what I thought when I saw that headline.
Absolutely. But in fact, what appears to have happened, and it is still domestic violence, but it's just not the type of domestic violence we think of, is that he appears to have got into a fight with his father. And he got him in a headlock, okay? Some sort of a dispute. Now, these are the charges that have been put against him. I have to emphasize that this has not been proven yet. What's transpired is that this happened on the 9th of March, and a couple of days before, Al-Ahmed brought two charges against his brother, okay? Sort of barring orders because they were intimidating him, right? So his two brothers had flown in from Germany and Russia, and Al-Ahmed, the hero of Bondi, had sponsored their visas to come for 3 months and visit him and support him in his hour of need. But it seems that they were trying to get money out of him. They were looking for $100,000 each from him. And he said no. So shortly after, this story about this conflict with his father happened in the house in Bankstown, which I mentioned earlier on. And it's all gone pretty badly from there.
So the charges against him are domestic violence, common assault, as well as stalking and intimidation.
Yeah.
Which he has denied.
He has denied. I mean, he's been very public in his denials. He's gone on local radio, he's gone on national radio. And I should be said it, he has never been shy about talking to the media. Humble man and all that he is, he has never been shy about talking to the media. So he went on to a well-known radio show in Sydney called the Ben Fordham Live. It's on CB2 Radio. And he did about a 13-minute interview on there. And he was very emotional on it. And he basically said, look, my brothers are trying to extort money from me. Simple as that. These charges are completely made up. And he actually referenced the footage from the time that he attacked Sajid Akram and disarmed him and said, look, even when I disarmed him, I could have shot him, but all I did was let him walk away and I put the gun down the ground or leaned it up against a tree or wherever it was he did. And it has to be said that the host of the show, Ben Fordham, was actually very sympathetic in this case.
Was he?
Unbelievable,
what?
Really. Yeah.
I was actually really shocked by this because obviously in Ireland we're really careful about what we say when somebody is before the courts, when somebody is facing charges.
I'm already getting messages from our listeners saying I donated to Ahmed, not to his brothers.
Allegation.
I don't believe them. I don't believe your brothers. I don't believe your dad. I don't believe any of them. You put your life on the line for this city and this country, and we will never forget that. I'm telling you. Look at me, Ahmed.
Yes.
I'll never, ever, ever forget what you did for the rest of my life. I've grown up in this city. I've lived in this city my whole life. It was the darkest day in our history, and you stood tall on behalf of every single one of us, and you did something that we all wish we would do. But in the bottom of our guts, we don't know whether we would have the balls to do it. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I hope that common sense prevails here. I don't know what went on or what didn't go on, but I find this all very hard to believe.
It was extraordinary.
Extraordinary stuff. And it's really worth listening to that interview, actually. But I have to say, like yourself, I was a bit shocked because he is in front of the courts. He does have charges that he needs to face. Whether in the interim the charges are going to be dropped against his brothers and the charges might be dropped against him, I don't know, to tell you the truth. But it has to be said that the police are the ones who are pressing the charges. So as Fordham did say in that radio interview, the police have got to do their job, I suppose. So he acknowledged that. So.
Oh, thanks. So what he was basically saying was that the dad wanted him to drop the charges against the brothers.
Yeah.
And that's why they got into this row and that's why he ended up getting his dad into a headlock.
That seems what happened in this case, yeah.
Okay.
Indeed the headlock aspect of the story is true, it could all be made up. We don't know yet.
We don't know. So the charges against his two brothers, where are they at, Jonathan?
So they're still standing. They came about shortly before this incident on the 9th of March, or the alleged incident on the 9th of March, where it's alleged that Al-Ahmed got his father in a headlock, right? And they came about because Al-Ahmed said that they had used a carriage service. In other words, they had phoned him in a menacing fashion, and they harassed him, and they both demanded $100,000, right, out of this fortune that he's accumulated because of his good deed. Now, as it stands, they were granted conditional bail, but there's a restraining order on the brothers, and they will have to, you know, they will have to answer for those charges. Now, interestingly, as we mentioned, they're only supposed to be in the country for 3 months, so I don't know what's going to happen in the interim there, but it's all going to play out in the courts.
So he's back before the courts on June 29th.
He is.
Which is next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
And do we know what's going to happen then?
He'll have to face the charges, I suppose, and see what the process is from there. Hopefully it'll work out for him. But I think what the irony of this is, in the same week that he appeared in court, the second shooter who survived, Naveed Akram, the 24-year-old, he was up for more charges. So you had, in the same week, you had the hero and the villain of Bondi both up in the dock. But I think in the balance of it all, it seems that Al Ahmed had gotten a lot more coverage than Naveed Akram did, which is a bit strange.
So that was the response from one programme, right, and one presenter. Mm. But across the media, I suppose, in Australia, how have they treated this story and these allegations against Al Ahmed?
I have to say it's been fairly light, in the sense that they've reported the fact that he was up on charges. I had to go digging a little bit to look for the story behind the charges, the headlock and this kind of thing. But one thing that did stand out to me was the fact that these two words, domestic violence, were included repeatedly in headlines. You know, if you have a look at Google or whatever, and you type in the story, you'll see over and over again, domestic violence, hammered home, this idea. And obviously that's headline writers. They've got to go with it because they need to get eyeballs on the story. But I have to say, I thought it was slightly misleading. I was even out for a couple of pints with mates of mine there, and I was telling them that I was doing this op-ed for the Irish Examiner. And one of them piped up and said, wasn't he up for domestic violence charges? And I said, oh yeah, I better look into that further.
And look,
thinking
we have to wait.
Exactly what the both of us thought.
And yet we have to wait and see how this all plays out in court. As I said, it's the police bringing these charges. He denies them, but ultimately it'll be up to the courts, and indeed potentially a jury in Australia, to decide on this. I just wonder how allegations against a public figure or community hero affect public perception of a person.
Yeah.
You know, can they be celebrated for these courageous actions, but then face these unrelated legal allegations?
So I think the big takeaway from this is the fact that this guy acted on impulse, right? He wasn't thinking about his past. He wasn't thinking about his future. He was just thinking about the moment. But all of a sudden, when he becomes the hero, he kind of belongs to everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing better than seeing a hero fall. Right, for many people.
No, but I actually think there's some truth in that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that how elements of the Australian media have treated this? You know?
There's certainly an element of sensationalism around it, and you have to feel a little bit sorry for him. Now, obviously the charges are there and he has to answer for them if it is, you know, if it is true. But I wonder, you know, how much coverage a story like this would have got if he hadn't, you know, come forward and did what he did on the day of Bondi. He certainly wasn't thinking about his past or his future when he acted in that moment. And it's kind of a warning for would-be heroes before they get involved.
Yeah, I think that's my takeaway from all of this, that this was an individual who was probably living a very ordinary, simple life. Mm. And now he has this millionaire status, this hero status, but actually it's brought him a huge amount of trouble.
It has, yeah, yeah. And it doesn't look like he's going to get out of it anytime soon.
All right, well, it's one we're going to watch here on Newstack. Jonathan de Burke-Butler, thank you so much for that.
Thanks for having me in.
That's it from the podcast for today. You can listen back to every episode of Newstalk Daily on the Go Loud Player or wherever it is that you listen to your pods. For now, from me, Ciara Doherty. Bye-bye.